Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 43, our second episode this week, of Speaking of Mysteries. Today's guest is Julia Dahl, whose debut mystery, Invisible City, which has been nominated for an Edgar Award, is available in paperback with an added bonus of the first two chapters of her follow-up mystery, Run You Down. I especially like Julia's explanation of some of the factors that led her to write a mystery, one of them being picking up a copy of Gillian Flynn's Sharp Objects. Here's Julia. Welcome back. Our guest today is Julia Dahl, whose Invisible City was released in 2014 and has been nominated for an Edgar Award for First Mystery. The paperback version is going to be published on March 10th, and in it is a teaser with the first two chapters of the follow-up book, Run You Down. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
Your protagonist, Rebecca Roberts, is a fascinating character. Can you tell us something about how you developed her, how she sprang into your mind?
Well, sure. In some ways, Rebecca is like me, and I imagine Rebecca as being a kind of person that I sort of both wish I were, and am glad I'm not. I worked for several years at the New York Post as a reporter, as a stringer, doing almost exactly the same job Rebecca does, which is get up in the morning, call into the city desk, and get told where to go, and just run around the city collecting quotes and information. And I was doing that job as a slightly older person. I was 30, and I'd been to journalism school, and I'd spent some time in the industry working at magazines and things like that. But as I was doing this work, which was really ethically and morally difficult, you know, showing up at people's doors minutes after they've been informed that someone in their family's died or been arrested or something like that, was difficult work, and you have almost no supervision or real support from your city desk as a runner or a stringer. And I felt like it was difficult for me to do as, you know, a 30-year-old. And I would see these people who were also doing the same job, but were almost 10 years younger than me, just out of college, 21 years old, with no experience and a lot less maturity than I had. And I started thinking, like, wow, it must be, what would it be like to do this job, this really tough job, 10 years younger than I was? And so I sort of started playing around with the idea of a character that was doing a job I knew, but was a lot less mature and also troubled and had sort of a backstory that also is a little bit like my own. Rebecca was born in Orlando, Florida. Her father is a Methodist minister, and her mother was a Hasidic Jew from Brooklyn. They met and fell in love and had a child out of wedlock when they were just teenagers, and then Rebecca's mom left, and they've never heard from her since. My own family is my mom is very much a part of my life. My mom is Jewish. My dad is Lutheran. He's actually a deacon in the Lutheran church, and so I grew up two religions, and part of my own journey as growing into adulthood was going between these two religious identities. So that's been a sort of a big part of the story of my life. And I wanted to tackle the issue of being sort of in the middle of two religions as well as being in this really difficult job and in the big city. And Rebecca moves from New York City to New York City from Orlando and is all of a sudden, you know, running all over the city as if she should know it, but she doesn't know it. So that's sort of where Rebecca came from.
Well, this is your debut mystery, and I might add that it's been nominated for an Edgar Award. Which I think I mentioned before, what nudged you toward writing a mystery? This is a two-part question. What nudged you toward writing a mystery? You were born in Fresno, which is William Saroyan country. And what writers influenced you growing up?
Well, oh, that's a great question. So I love getting questions about writing. I you know, I wrote, and I'd always, starting when I was a teenager, I got into kind of creative writing. It just felt like something, you know, I would scribble bad poetry in my notebook and things like that. It just sort of came out of me. And I wrote short stories in college and things like that. And then in my early or mid-20s, I went to the New School to get an MFA in fiction and wrote a novel that actually took place in Fresno, and it was pretty bad. it was, you know, I was really interested in the characters, and, you know, I joked that it was like, it didn't really have a plot. It was kind of like a mood piece. And, you know, not surprisingly, I couldn't find an agent. I couldn't find a publisher. And so I ended up going back to journalism and making that my professional life. And out of that journalism came this book. But when I put fiction aside for a few years, and actually I was still writing fiction, but I wasn't writing it super seriously. And finally, I just asked myself, I said, you know, what are the books I like to read? And the answer was clear. It was mysteries. I've been reading mysteries since I was a kid. You know, I mean, I was in the Agatha Christie Book of the Month Club in like 1985, and I would get, you know, a beautifully leather-bound Agatha Christie every month. And, that, you know, then I graduated to like Stephen King and Dean Koontz and John Grisham. And those were the books and the stories that I always went back to. I loved also reading, you know, good literature, obviously. But the plot and the sort of whodunit was, in some ways, I mean, it was the books that I always returned to, but it was also, I think, a way for me to get back into fiction with a little bit of a trajectory already set out for me. You know, I don't want to say that mysteries are formulaic, because obviously many great mysteries are not formulaic, but I felt like there was sort of a template that, you know, a body is found and at the end you figure out who killed the person. And that allowed me, having that template, sort of knowing the beginning and knowing the end, allowed me, I think, to finish this book. I don't know if I could have finished it if I had had to sort of figure out some end that didn't have to do with the whodunit. I started writing the book in about 2007, and I started thinking about writing a mystery, I want to say in about 2005, I was in a bookstore and I saw a book called Sharp Objects by Gillian Flynn. Now, my first job out of college was that I was
a great book, by the way, a great book.
I mean, I devoured it. Well, and I saw it, and I remember being drawn to the cover with that razor blade on it. And I looked on the back and I recognized the author, because I had worked years before as an intern at Entertainment Weekly, and Gillian Flynn at the time was a TV writer there, and I would like make photocopies for her and stuff, and she was very nice. And then all of a sudden I see her name on the back of the book, and I think, oh my gosh, I kind of know her. So I, you know, bought the book and devoured it immediately and thought, this is the kind of book I want to write. I want to write something dark and creepy with a female protagonist. And so I started reading her. You know, I picked up Dark Places. I started reading Tana French, Kate Atkinson, and I was just off and running. I thought that, you know, there is now a movement of these women writing literary thrillers. I started reading one of my favorite books of all time is Strangers on a Train, and I just devoured all of Patricia Highsmith because I so admire her, the sort of mood she creates, and the way that she can write male and female characters so well. I found that really inspiring. Of course, I read William Saroyan as a kid. I also, you know, I am a huge admirer of John Steinbeck, because I do believe in sort of the moral mission of the writer, that we are, you know, we hold a mirror up to society and show the people the what is bad and what is good, and that helps us to move forward and examine ourselves. But the books that, you know, the books I'm reading now, like actually right now I'm reading I Am Pilgrim by Terry Hayes. Yeah. So in some ways the mystery, I feel like it was like coming home. These are the books that I read, and this is the kind of book I want to write.
Well, I have a question, you know, as a former journalist myself, and something I've talked to other writers who have become mystery writers. Did you have that disconnect, dubious practices aside, which I don't think that many journalists subscribe to, but that you can actually sit down and write something that isn't true when you're writing fiction?
Yes. Yes, it's so freeing. I mean, because my book takes place, it's about a murder in the Hasidic community in Borough Park, which is a community that I'm very interested in, or as an outsider, as a, Reformed Jew. I would see these people in the black hats and the wigs and think, these people are Jews like me, but they're not at all like me. And I was just very curious about them. But even though I spent a lot of years and still am kind of slowly making friends in that community, they're getting really great, juicy, meaningful stories on the record in that community and in a lot of communities is just practically impossible, especially for someone who's an outsider. And what I'm interested as a writer is people's internal lives and why they do what they do. And with fiction, obviously you want it to ring true, and you have to be, research is important for that. And, but I just, it's so, exactly, it's so freeing to be able to sit down with my computer and be like, my job is to just make stuff up. It's so cool. And obviously, like I said, it has to ring true, but it's really freeing. And I feel like it's just exercising a whole different part of my brain that I want to exercise and that keeps me up at night thinking about stories and why people do what they do. But that I can't, like I said, I can't get on the record.
Well, that anticipates my next question. In Invisible City, Rebecca is following this story that involves members of Brooklyn's ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. And I was wondering if researching the subject was difficult.
It was. I mean, I started writing this book in 2007, and I didn't finish it until about 2012. Some of that was, I was working full time, and it takes a while to write a book, but a lot of it was because I really knew very little about this community. So I, the first thing I did was just start reading. I read a book called Unchosen, The Hidden Lives of Hasidic Rebels by a woman named Hella Winston, and that was really useful. And then I just started, started opening up articles in the Jewish Daily Forward and started paying more attention to stories that came out of that ultra-Orthodox community. I also sort of used my role as a journalist to pitch and write stories about that community. I wrote a story about policing insular religious communities. And when I would finish interviewing the sources, one man was a man who had founded a group that was advocating for and doing counseling with victims of sexual abuse in the Hasidic community. I finished. Do you mind? Can I, buy you a cup of coffee and ask you a few more questions? I'm working on this novel. And he was really generous with his time. And then he introduced me to a friend of his who is also Orthodox and is a member of the NYPD, who ended up being the model for the character of Saul in the book. And then I just started reaching out to people. Once I felt like I had a little bit of a understanding of the community, I started literally being on like Facebook and looking people up. There are these unbelievable communities of people who, many of whom have left the ultra-Orthodox and are living more modern lives, so they're more interested and willing to talk to an outsider about the lives that they had and about the community. So I would, say, hey, can I buy you a drink? Can I buy you a cup of coffee? And ask you a whole bunch of questions. And so many people, some of whom I thank in the acknowledgments of my book, were willing to spend their time with me and share their stories with me. And, it took a long time, but once you meet one person and they trust you, they're willing to say, hey, you should call my friend. He's got a really interesting story. And then that person introduces you to another person. So it was a sort of series of dominoes, but it did take a long time, and I knew that I couldn't, you know, the book is written not from an outsider's perspective. Rebecca, the main character and narrator, is not ultra-Orthodox. But and because I knew I couldn't write a book from the point of view of someone who had grown up in the Haredi community, that I just didn't have the knowledge base. So in some ways, I allowing that character to be discovering things about the world as I'm discovering things about the world, I think worked.
Have you had any reaction to the book from members of the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community or maybe just Orthodox Jewish community? Because maybe ultra-Orthodox would read it, but I'm curious
right.
what the reaction from the community was. I thought from what little I know that the portrayal looked very accurate and even-handed.
I have had some response, and for the most part, it's been pretty positive. I don't think a lot of people in the Haredi ultra-Orthodox community have read the book. In fact, I'm pretty sure most haven't. Even some who have reached out, but some people have reached out to me, hearing that I've written the book and seeing me on social media talking about the community and issues. And even though they haven't taken the time to read the book for whatever reason, I've gotten to know a few more people inside the community because they seem to understand happily that I'm interested in learning about them, and they're interested in helping me to learn about them and to tell other people in a larger non-Orthodox community about them. I did have one piece of negative feedback from someone I admire very much, a psychiatrist who works actually in the prison system, and who I have known for many years as a source for my work writing about criminal justice. He's I'm not sure if he would consider himself modern Orthodox or more conservative, but he wrote me a note saying that he'd read the book and he felt like he couldn't recommend it to his Orthodox friends because he thought it was too negative. And, you know, it took me aback a little because I definitely feel like the portrayal is fair. I mean, obviously I'm writing about a murder, so the book is on the dark side. But I, you know, we had a discussion about it and he, you know, he just felt like, I felt like you focused too much on the negatives in the community. And I, you know, I can accept that criticism. But for the most part, the people who've read it have said to me, the Jews who've read it, that they found it fair and interesting and that it taught them things about that community that they didn't know. But I will say that also my mom, who's Jewish but Reform, when I told her that I was writing the book, so this was years ago, was unhappy, at least at the beginning. She sort of said, Julia, the world already hates the Jews. Why would you write a book that makes Jews look bad? And, you know, I took that to heart, and I've thought a lot about it since. And, you know, I think it's a legitimate question. You know, my answer and what I've said to her, and now that she's read the book, I think she feels very comfortable with it, and she, you know, is constantly taking me to Jewish book clubs and things like that. Is that, you know, I just don't believe that any community is above scrutiny. And I felt like there were things going on in this community, secrecy, you know, lack of education, that I wanted to look at and that I thought were worth examining. So far, it's been pretty positive. I don't know how, you know, if the next book is told partly from the point of view of someone who grew up ultra-Orthodox. And I imagine that I might take a little more flack from that because, you know, I'm writing in the voice of someone that I am not. But I'm hopeful that just as women write in the voice of men and men write in the voice of women, that I've gotten it. That it rings true.
In New York City, do you think that the wall between the secular world and the ultra-Orthodox world is getting stronger or more porous? Because I've been to Brooklyn, and it really is a community within a community, and there are no stone walls surrounding their neighborhood, but there almost might as well be.
Right.
I've always felt when I've gone there that it's almost like being dropped into another universe. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I think that for the ultra-Orthodox communities that move away from New York City, I can certainly see that the walls are getting stronger to prevent the outside world. But this is a very insular community in the largest city in the United States and one of the largest cities in the world. So that's what makes me wonder if there is more going through the walls than maybe before or less.
You know, it's a great question. I think that, and that's exactly what drew me to this community, was this idea that, you know, we live in this great melting pot, and yet this community in many ways they sort of take care of their own. They speak their own language. I mean, obviously there are hundreds of languages spoken in New York City, but there's really an effort to keep their lives focused on and in some ways, let's see. There's an effort to keep their lives only within the community. There's a huge lack of trust of non-Jews and not just non-Jews, but non-Haredi Jews, old Orthodox Jews. And some of that comes from, you know, the legacy of the Holocaust. I remember a friend of mine who grew up ultra-Orthodox and has since left, described it as sort of a mass community-wide post-traumatic stress syndrome, that these are people descended directly from victims of the Holocaust, and there's a real palpable sense of fear of the outside world. But yeah, I think that, and I know that in you know, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of their children, for example, go to yeshivas where, frankly, state educational standards are not met, and yet the city turns a blind eye. Kids are, boys especially, essentially stop their quote-unquote secular education at about 12, and they begin studying Torah almost exclusively. From my perspective, this is a problem. My perspective as the sort of white, middle-class, liberal American feminist is that we are all in this together as Americans, and the insularity and the sort of fear of the outside is something that I have a bit of a problem with. What's changing, what's interesting is that over the last 30 years, this generation of Haredi who are my age and a little older, so somewhere between like 30 and 50, have gotten much more conservative. I talked to a lot of people who grew up in Borough Park in the 50s and 60s and watched it change and watched it become much, much more conservative and much more insular. But now that the internet has become a fact of life for everyone, I think that is changing things. There's a real fear in the community of what the internet and how that opens up the doors to all kinds of ideas and all kinds of people will do to the community. A year or two ago, the ultra-Orthodox filled Shea Stadium. So we're talking 40 or 50,000 men filled Shea Stadium in an anti-internet rally. A lot of the people in this community aren't allowed to they have rabbi-approved phones, so phones that can't get on the internet. And yet you just can't harness human curiosity. And, you know, 20 years ago, if I'm a woman, man or woman living in this community, and I am unhappy, I don't want to live this life, my path out is very difficult. If I've been grown up in this community, my English is perhaps poor, my education is limited, my interaction with the community outside is very limited, so I don't have any kind of support system or job skills or anything like that. Leaving is incredibly difficult. But now you can get on Facebook and in 2 minutes find a group of hundreds or thousands of other people who grew up just like you and are thinking about leaving or thinking about ways of living that are different, that aren't as strict. And I just don't think, I think that that has opened a door and will continue to open a door to a lot more people. And as people are leaving, I have a friend who grew up ultra-Orthodox Hasidic in Borough Park. Her father's a rabbi. She was married at 19. has four children, and just after her fourth child was born, she never loved her husband. She was miserable. She left him and has been fighting to get custody of her kids since, and now has joint custody. But just last weekend, I went to her. Her kids are now older, and she threw a bar and bat mitzvah party for her children. And she is a really interesting woman. She's really embraced her sort of sexuality now that she's left the Hasidic world. But she's also incredibly devoted to her Judaism. And so at this bar bat mitzvah party, half the people there were in black hats with the payas and women with their shaitels. And the other half were like tattooed and body piercers. And it was just such a beautiful party because everyone was dancing together and celebrating these two children becoming adults in the Jewish faith. And it was, I think that something like that really wouldn't have happened even 20 years ago. And now I think that as more people are leaving, the people that are still in the community don't want to lose connection with their family members if possible. And so there's this kind of slow coming together of maybe we can still accept you. Maybe we can live as a family with different ideas.
Your second book in the series is about to come out, Run You Down. Its pub date is in June. As I said in the paperback, you can read the first two chapters. So I think it's safe to say that the alternating voices are Rebecca and her mother, Aviva.
Yes.
And how many books do you see in the arc of the series, if you're thinking that way, or is it sort of open-ended?
I definitely want to do a third book. I have an idea. I have sort of an outline, so I'm very hopeful that that'll work out and that I'll be getting started on that within the next couple weeks. After that, I'm less sure. I would love to continue writing with Rebecca. I mean, one of the things that's really fun about a reporter, a little bit like a detective, you know, you can take her anywhere. And I like Rebecca. I like that. I think, you know, that she's growing up a little bit. And I think there are just so many stories to tell all in the ultra Orthodox world, but also, you know, one of the things that I've thought about is taking her down to Florida. Her father's a Methodist youth minister down in Orlando, Florida. And, the world of the sort of her father's not an evangelical type minister, but I'm interested in exploring, you know, a religious group that is not the ultra Orthodox. I think there's a lot, there's just so many stories to tell. And, I'd love to switch it up a little, maybe do something like that. I also though have a couple ideas for non Rebecca Roberts books that I would love to do. So I guess it's a little, I really hope that there'll definitely be a third. And, you know, in my fantasy land, I get to do a little bit what Kate Atkinson's does, you know, where I can occasionally write about Jackson Brody, and then I can occasionally write about other stuff. You know, I might as well dream big, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I've spoken to authors about sort of the tyranny of the series and why they like to do standalones. Val McDermott was very eloquent on that point. She needs to step back from her series and do a standalone. It's sort of like a you know, flushes her mind,
right? Like a palate cleanser almost.
And, you know, and then she looks forward to getting back to her characters. And certainly, you're right, Tana French, who sort of drops in and out, and Kate Atkinson. So I think that sounds like a great plan.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely other stories. You know, the tyranny of this series is that it's really Rebecca's series, and as much as I like Rebecca, there are other women and other kinds of women and men that I'm interested in writing about, so I don't want to get sick of her. I really don't, because I really like her. And I imagine that, you know, after three books and how many years, almost, you know, if I write another book, it'll be getting on 10 years of my life writing about Rebecca. It might be time to switch it up for a minute. I feel like Rebecca has a lot, obviously a lot of learning to do, but also I'm excited about sort of the trajectory of her career. You know, how long will she stay at the Trib? Will she go into more long form? Will she end up doing, you know, nonprofit journalism? There's just a lot.
You know, I'm looking forward to reading Run You Down. I think Rebecca is a very unique character, a strong woman, but at the same time, a strong woman with her issues. I mean, she, at the beginning of the book, of the second book, Run You Down, she's visiting a psychiatrist. She's been, she admits that she has always suffered from anxiety, and now she's got a little post-traumatic stress disorder on top of that. So I think that that's also sort of a very 21st century addition to who she is. She doesn't have a drinking problem, which she might have if she'd been a 20th century detective or journalist. But now she's in the 21st century and she has this. Does this sort of inform her character, or is it just like a little bit of a thing and it doesn't really mean anything?
No, I think it does. I mean, mental illness, you know, I mean, one of the big themes of Invisible City is the issue of mental illness and the idea that untreated mental illness, like untreated cancer or diabetes, can kill you. And it can make you into a very, or it can make you into a very, very sick person, a person that you really aren't. And that, you know, mental illness is something that's touched my life and very much touched the lives of a lot of my family members. And it's always been important to me to break the stigma of talking about, you know, suffering from anxiety and depression and, you know, seeing a therapist or taking medication, that doesn't make you weak. And for Rebecca, you know, I wanted to explore, I've read a lot about I've seen a lot of characters suffer with depression and I hadn't seen a lot of characters suffer from anxiety, and I've suffered from both. And while depression in some ways really stopped my life for about a year when I was in college, in some ways I think anxiety was more difficult for me to deal with. It was more frightening and more debilitating, possibly because I didn't really understand it at all. Depression, you know, I mean, there's a million memoirs of people dealing with depression, and anxiety is just something that I don't think is talked about as much, but I think is very common. I know it's very common and can also be very debilitating. So it was important to me that Rebecca was struggling with something that a lot of women and men, but specifically women I know, struggle with, but that she was always pushing through, that she did not let it take over her life or stop her from doing the things she wants to do. And I think that's really important, showing people that you can suffer from these ailments and they can make you very sick, but that they don't have to take your life away.
No, and I agree. In Invisible City, she's very upfront about her anxiety and recognizing the symptoms of her anxiety and pushing through. And I do think that that's important. And I do think that that this book has, Invisible City specifically, has a very refreshing sort of attitude of her anxiety is not unlike if she had eczema.
Right. I mean, she's just not going to let it, make her hide or change what she wants to be. It's like, you know, it's like having a bum leg or something. I mean, it's something she has to carry around with her, and sometimes it flares up and sometimes it makes it hard to walk and to work and to have relationships. And it's something she'll probably deal with for the rest of her life. But that struggle is just a part of who she is.
Well, at least she'll be struggling with it through what I hope is going to be a long series. I think anybody who's read this book would want to read more beyond the second book. And I very much look forward to it.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited about the next book. It's different, as you say, it's alternating narration, but I think it's maybe a little more ambitious. But I'm just really excited about it. I'm nervous because it's, you know, It's different, but I can't wait to get it out there.
Well, I wish you a tremendous amount of luck at the Edgars. Thank you, Julia Dahl, for joining us. And good luck at the Edgars in April. And good luck with your next book, Run Me Down.
Thank you.
Next week's guest is Owen Lokinen, whose fourth Stevens and Windermere novel, The Stolen Ones, is being released on March 18th. We also spoke to Owen's alter ego, Owen Matthews, whose first YA novel, How to Win at High School, was published 2 weeks ago. Until then, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.